Hi, welcome to the Set Python Girls Club podcast. I'm your host, Luciana.
And I'm your co-host, Kim Madeline. Let's get going. Hello and welcome to this new episode of the Set Python Girls Club podcast. Hi, Luciana. How's it going?
Hey, Kim Madeline. I'm doing all right. How are you doing today?
I'm doing okay. The weather is not as bad as it was just before, so I don't have to live with 24/7 rain. So I think it's less depressing, but we'll have to see.
That's true. I actually saw a little bit of sunlight today. It's cloudy now, but at least it was nice seeing that weird yellow light that I rarely ever remember exists in the world.
But talking about Sun being our special guest for today, we also have a special guest on this episode. Today's guest is Alice Lee from the Copilot team. Welcome, Alice. How's it going?
Thank you. Thank you. Very happy to be here. I'm doing great. The weather here in Chicago is also quite terrible, as it usually is this time of the year, but I'm crossing my fingers for some sunshine this weekend.
Praying for you as well. So first things first, would you mind introducing yourself?
Yeah, happy to. So hi, everyone. I'm Alice. I am the tech lead for the Copilot model improvements team at GitHub, where my role, broadly speaking, is thinking about ways to make Copilot better for users. That's also where I met Kim Adeline, where we work together.
Since this is the Sad Python Girls Club podcast, where do you use Python in your workflow, Alice? Or do you use Python in your workflow at all?
Oh, yeah, for sure. So, I think all of the deep learning stuff that I do is in Python. Outside of work, I play around with training models myself, and I do all of that in Python. So like in TensorFlow, PyTorch, etc. And then at Copilot, we do use quite a lot of Python, especially in our data analysis and how we evaluate new models. So yeah, lots of Python.
Do you use VS Code for your Python development?
I do use VS Code.
Amazing. Thank you for that.
So, general take, what do you think of Copilot?
I love Copilot. I mean, it's one of those things where actually before I joined the team, at the time we were in technical preview, so it wasn't something that like anyone could sign up for, right? So I didn't actually get to use Copilot until after I joined the team. And it is one of those things where you get used to it over time, but then maybe you're working on a different computer, you haven't set it up, and then you're like, oh gosh, something's really missing, right? And then it's like, you don't have your little programming assistant with you. And I definitely find myself even sometimes pleasantly surprised by the kinds of suggestions I'm getting from it, where it's like, oh wow, okay, you're doing a really good job right now, thanks buddy.
Do you think Copilot has fundamentally changed the way you approach code? Like, I know that for me, when I use it, I noticed that instead of spending more time writing code, I spend time reviewing the suggestions that Copilot gave me. So it kind of changed my approach when it came to, well, yeah, coding.
Yeah, for sure. And I think I've heard this from a lot of people as well. It's like there's almost kind of a virtuous cycle that's sparked by using it, where, for example, you typically get better completions if you comment your code more, right? Or if you document it more. And in that sense, it kind of incentivizes you to be more thoughtful about what you're writing, to add more documentation and commenting throughout. And I think it's kind of a nice back and forth in that sense, where you start being more intentional about your code, you start getting better completions from Copilot, and then you continue kind of generating better code together in a way.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Zooming out, where do you see the trends of generative AI moving towards? Using AI for multiple kinds of purposes. So where do you see that going in the future?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think one thing that's exciting about being in the space is that it's changing so much, right? And every week, it seems like there's a new model coming out with more exciting capabilities. I've been in this space for a couple of years now, which is, you know, not a long time in the grand scheme of things, but a decent chunk of time in this space to think about how the landscape looked when I first started doing this kind of work compared to now. And so when I think back to when I started doing generative AI, this was around when kind of some of the more exciting models coming out were in the vision space. So this was when like StyleGAN, StyleGAN 2 were coming out, and you know had these viral websites like thispersondoesnotexist.com, for example, which, you know, I don't know if you guys have seen, but it's one of those things where it's like the faces look completely real, but it's synthesized, right? And I remember back then that was kind of blowing everyone's mind, but generative models were very kind of specific to particular modalities. So you had vision models, you had language models. When I got started back then, I think we were on GPT-2. And then when GPT-3 came out eventually, that was blowing everyone's mind, right? Where over time, I think you're getting better and better quality, but you're also getting more consistent quality. So it's not like, you know, you generate 100 outputs and most of them are terrible, but one is good. Increasingly, you're getting, you know, 10% look good, 20% look good, and so on and so forth. And I feel like in the past couple of years with things like, you know, DALL-E or Stable Diffusion, you're getting more multimodal models where these models are increasingly powerful. They're able to kind of synthesize, understand domains ranging from text to images to even sound, and kind of synthesize the links between those different domains. And it's very exciting, but I think it's also changed a little bit in the way that machine learning developers work in these spaces, where maybe a couple of years ago you would train your own models from scratch. And increasingly, when your base models that you're starting with are more and more powerful, it starts becoming more about like prompt crafting or fine tuning. And so like one thing that's kind of sprung up recently that's a little funny is there are these websites out there that are dedicated to selling prompts that have been proven to work well in large models. So for example, like you can pay, you know, a couple of dollars to get some prompts that will give you really nice images coming out of Stable Diffusion. It's like a different mode of engaging with AI in a way where instead of like building your own model from scratch, these models are so increasingly powerful that there's a lot of space to explore just like getting different things out of these incredibly large models.
That's amazing. I love how there's a whole new business model, I guess, that was launched because of this new technology that is advancing so much. I find it funny because I was trying out ChatGPT because it's in preview, like most folks in tech are trying out now, I guess. And I'm finding myself so dependent on it. I spent like a month in Brazil over the holidays. So when I came back, I was struggling to get back to like Englishing. And as I was phrasing things in emails and things like that, I was always referring to ChatGPT to be like, hey, can you fix this? Can you communicate this better? And now I'm like getting so used to it to a point that I'm afraid I'll become dependent on generative AI to answer emails and messaging, right? So it's kind of like scary to a point how much we end up relying on these models for a lot of things. It changes the paradigm, exactly like you were saying and Madeline was saying as well when it comes to coding. But it's very exciting and kind of scary to think about what will the future be like as we depend on AI for various areas of our work and life.
For sure. Yeah. And I think, you know, one very understandable fear that a lot of people have is this going to replace humans? And I think my perspective has been and still remains no. I think it's a lot of the times when we interact with these models, you know, especially if you're just kind of like reading a paper, seeing a demo, you're seeing the best cherry picked examples from it, right? But like to use any of these models in any kind of meaningful way, whether it's in a business setting or your day-to-day life, like there still requires a decent amount of both human prompting to get good outputs as well as human review. You know, like even a model as powerful as ChatGPT, a lot of the times you'll be interacting with it and then you'll just get something from it where you're like, no, that's not true or that's not correct. And so it's like a tool that exists for you that can help speed up a lot of what you do. But I think there will always be a human element required to actually look at what it's giving you and say, does this make sense? Because at the end of the day, I think the human brain is still, you know, exponentially more powerful than even the biggest, most powerful state-of-the-art models today.
Could you explain a little bit what goes into prompt crafting and fine tuning and what the challenges are behind it? Because I assume that's where most of the human touch is going to be needed.
Yeah, so prompt crafting refers to the content that you feed into an existing model. So for example, you know, what you type into something like Stable Diffusion, like the text that you type into, that's prompting it to generate outputs based on the inputs you're providing it. And then fine tuning is something that's a little bit more applicable to if you're a machine learning developer, where if you're taking an existing model, you can then feed it additional data samples in order to have the model actually change its underlying weights and adapt to a particular domain. So, you know, in the image generation example, you might have you might want a model that becomes really, really good at generating, let's say, contemporary art. So maybe you fine tune it, especially on many, many samples of contemporary art. You don't care about it being able to generate Renaissance paintings. And then the model is specifically adapting to the new samples that you're showing it. And so in both these cases, yeah, it's like in the first example, it's kind of the user. In the second example, it's the developer. But there's also this degree of human intentionality in nudging the model in the right direction and kind of setting the boundaries, if you will, for what you want the model to care about versus what you don't want it to care about. And that kind of, you know, data set curation, fine tuning case is incredibly important. I think we've seen over the years, there's been various, you know, well-publicized incidents where big tech companies with amazing, powerful models have actually sort of underperformed or even done kind of like offensive things once shipped to production, because the model only knows what you've shown it, right? Like its knowledge is always finite. Even if it's the world's best model, it's seen a static, limited set of information. So that's why it's always incredibly important to make sure that whatever you're feeding the model is actually appropriate, that it makes sense for your use case, but also to keep in mind that because that's a static snapshot, like as things change over time, you're going to want to have to refresh your model with the latest knowledge or the latest data points, because the world is changing. And so these models won't change unless you give them new information to allow them to change with the state of the world.
When you mentioned models that underperform when put into production, I was thinking of Tay. I think it was Microsoft's experiment on Twitter.
Right.
That,
yeah.
It did not go well at all.
Oh my God.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think Google also had like a very, unfortunate incident where I think they had like an image classification model where it was like taking, you know, the pictures in the cloud in your Google account and automatically classifying them based on, you know, is this a picture of a cat? Is this a picture of a dog? And unfortunately, I think there were some racial biases baked into that model. And it was kind of, you know, a big deal once people realized it was doing that. And so that's why it's incredibly important to sort of remember the limitations of these models and kind of the nuances involved, and to be very intentional when you're building one to say, you know, what am I really wanting it to do? And how do I make sure that I'm being fair and representative in what this model is learning from?
Yeah, and I think that ties well with the whole conversations and concerns around ethical AI and making sure we're creating products and models actually for everyone, right? And I think like a big important piece of that is having a diverse set of folks on the development side of the tools, right? Because we tend to, everyone has our unconscious bias, everyone is biased in one way, but when we have like a diverse set of folks, we can kind of like smooth out these biases and make sure we're thinking about the broader population and that minorities are not being excluded in the way that we are feeding our models with data and all of that, right? So I am very happy to hear that we have you on Copilot and Kim Adeline as well as examples of women who are in tech, that we know it's not like a lot of us out there, but I think it's important to have people like you, us working on models like that. So it makes me happy to see that this is happening.
Yeah, absolutely.
And what are the main challenges that you face or have faced as a woman in AI, since we're talking about that?
Yeah, I think, you know, being a woman in tech more broadly, you do often find yourself being the only woman in the room in many instances. And in a field like AI, you know, it's one of those fields where because things are changing all the time, there's never really a sense that you've mastered everything, right? There's always some amount of information that you know, and then there's a new paper that you haven't read because it came out last week, or, you know, there are entire domains that you're not as familiar with because it's such a big field and it's changing all the time. And I think one thing that certainly affects a lot of women and minorities in a lot of settings, tech included, is kind of this feeling of, do I belong or not? So many years ago, in a former job, I was working with a group of researchers who were working on belonging and growth mindset interventions. And so their work had identified that for, it was specifically focusing on students, but I think the ideas were more broadly applicable, where if you are someone who is underrepresented in an environment and you're going through, you know, the typical challenges in that environment, you're much more likely to interpret those normal challenges as being indicative of some personal failing. So in this particular case, it was like, for example, if you are someone whose entire family has gone to college and you're in your first semester in college and you do poorly on an exam, you know, you might think to yourself, oh, that's a bummer, but I'll study hard next time. I'll get tutoring. This is something that happens to everyone. Whereas if you're the first person in your family to attend college or you find yourself underrepresented, you might instead do poorly on exam and think, oh no, this is proof that I don't belong here, and become discouraged and, you know, kind of continue then struggling and withdrawing because you feel like you're doing something wrong on a personal level. And so extrapolating more broadly, like in tech and in AI, it can feel like that sometimes too, right? Where often maybe you're encountering a new, very large code base and you don't know everything, or you're learning a new technique or approaching a new problem for the first time. And there can be this inclination to say, oh no, you know, I made a mistake, or I feel very confused and overwhelmed by this new problem that I'm tackling, and to doubt yourself and say, maybe this means that I'm not cut out for it, especially if you're the only person in the room. And I think it's taken me, you know, a lot of time and sort of experience to be able to correct those thoughts when they do arise for me. But I think more importantly, as you're working with like more junior team members or people who are newer to the field, to also support them and normalize the experiences of challenge. So when you have a newer team member, someone who's fresh out of college, you know, you can see that maybe they're getting discouraged or they're struggling with something that they're working on, to be really open and explicit about, hey, you know, like a lot of the times I don't know the answers to questions either, or, you know, it can feel like I don't know what I'm doing, but that's normal. That's okay. We all go through that. And these are things that can be overcome with practice, with learning. And it's not indicative of anything that's wrong with you. It's just something that, you know, everyone goes through because we're tackling hard problems, and that can be challenging at times, but that's also kind of what makes this field exciting and part of the fun.
I totally agree, and I can 200% relate to everything you're saying. Not every day, but often it's a struggle of, what am I doing here? Because I see that other folks can be like, can look like they know what they're doing, but then I have to remind myself that nobody was born with innate knowledge of what is going on. But something I wanted to ask, what would you say, like, being open about not knowing things is something I agree with, like, to show that, again, nobody was born with that knowledge. But I feel that there's some deeply entrenched biases that when a woman shows that she doesn't know how to solve something, it might mean that she's incompetent. Well, if it's a person in position of power, then it's them being open about feedback. I guess I have these internalized biases to reconcile as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is really hard, I think. I've tried to, I don't know, maybe make up for a little bit by, if you have a reputation of, you know, in general, you can deliver, you can succeed on projects, then that's kind of like a baseline where people know in general that you're competent. And so maybe it's okay if sometimes, you know, you express vulnerability. But it's definitely a bit of a tricky balance, I would say, especially because I think some things that are, you know, typically coded as feminine, they might just be interpreted a certain way by people, whether you intend them or not. Yeah, it's definitely tricky, something that I'm working on every day.
Okay, so if you have one advice to give to folks on how to cope with imposter syndrome, what would that be?
I think one thing that's really useful is to talk to people who have maybe been in your shoes before, but are maybe, you know, a couple of years ahead of you, right? And to hear about their struggles when they were in the same phase as you, or even just to look back on like previous periods of your life. And, you know, maybe at the time something seemed really hard and now you've done it a million times, you're like, oh, that's easy. I find charting that journey of personal growth, whether it's your own or someone else's, does really help contextualize the sense of we're all growing and learning every day, right? And you might feel alone in not knowing how to do something or not knowing what something means, but that's something that you've personally overcome over the years and that a lot of other people who've been in your positions have successfully overcome as well.
Would you be open to being such a person that people can turn to?
Yeah, absolutely. I love helping people. I don't know. It's a good feeling to be able to like form that human connection, you know, and
yeah,
like,
I agree.
Reassure others that things are going to be okay, especially people who are working in the same field as you.
I feel that the most daunting part is reaching out to people, and you never know how it's going to end up, right? Like if they're going to be willing to help, because it's still a time commitment. It feels nice to help people, but it's also, how do I put this? It can get emotionally loaded, I guess.
That's true. Yeah. I think that, you know, the onus too then falls on people like anyone listening to this podcast who is maybe in a position where they're able to offer that kind of guidance to people in their organization, just like be more open about your struggles or, you know, position yourself as someone who others can feel more comfortable reaching out to. And it doesn't necessarily have to be like a really in-depth conversation, right? It can even just be, you know, if a team member is talking about how they're struggling with a particular code base, to just kind of echo, yeah, you know, when I was new to this team, it also took me a long time to figure out how to work with this code base. And I was very confused and even discouraged at times, but eventually I was able to kind of figure it out and make some meaningful contributions. So it can be something that's just kind of like embedded in your everyday interactions with people, where instead of projecting kind of the sense of perfection to open up about things that maybe you've struggled with are relevant to what they're doing, but also to offer productive advice on how they can get over those humps.
Mm-hmm. I agree. Thank you for the tip. Hopefully we can make the tech world like kinder one step at a time.
Fingers crossed.
But while you muster the courage to be vulnerable and open yourself to others, that is a perfect segue to the second half of the podcast, where we ask you what kind of sad song you listen to while trying to build the confidence to ask that question and reach out to other people.
Yeah, that's a great question, because most of the music I listen to, I would say, is pretty sad.
Oh, perfect.
I really like kind of experimental noise music, you know, so a lot of it is very gloomy and very harsh, and sometimes it sounds like horror movie music, as people say, but I find it a little bit cathartic, you know. So one artist that I really like is a Danish sound artist called Puce Mary. Really, like, all of her releases are great, but one of her tracks is called Red Desert, and it's kind of this very, at first it's very melancholic, but it sort of has this, like, kind of very uplifting vibe towards the end in a way, and it sort of has this feeling of catharsis almost, where it's like, you know, you can kind of dwell on all of your bad feelings for a bit, but, like, at the end, you kind of feel the beginnings of starting to transcend that, and it's a very powerful track. I really like it.
I love it. I feel like it's on brand with our brand as well, right? Like, we're sad, but we also have those moments of uplifting conversations.
I'm going to have to listen to it. It sounds life-changing, or at least podcast-changing. So thank you for the recommendation.
Yeah, please report back. I want to hear what you think.
And while you listen to this track and go through a roller coaster of emotions, what would be the best kind of ice cream to go with it?
Ooh, okay. So I have two flavors of kind of go-to ice creams. One is I really like stracciatella gelato. So like it's like chocolate pieces, you know, in like kind of a vanilla ice cream. But I also am very fond of any kind of like tea-based ice cream. So Earl Grey or matcha. I like that little bit of bitterness in with the sweetness.
Ooh, tea-based ice cream.
Yeah, I had a really good Earl Grey gelato once when I was like, I don't know, in some city I don't live in for the summer. And I've kind of dreamt of it ever since. I want to go back and eat that ice cream again.
One final question. How do you feel about pistachio ice creams? And I'm only asking because Kim Adeline, that's her absolute favorite. So there isn't a right answer to this question.
I like pistachios. I don't know if I've had a good pistachio ice cream before, but it sounds like Kim Adeline needs to take me to her favorite ice cream parlor in Vancouver the next time I'm there so I can try it.
Ooh, Savannah in the previous episode had a great pistachio ice cream recommendation. I've been on the lookout for a good pistachio ice cream in Vancouver because most of the ice creams you get here are like highlighter green and not great, like the bad pistachio ice cream we were talking about. But okay, I'll have to polish my recommendations and oh no, I have to test out multiple mug pistachio ice creams now. No.
Oh no.
Poor me. What is going to happen really? But it's for you, Alice. I can take on this hard work to help find the best pistachio ice cream.
Thank you.
Before trying it out, make sure to text Kim Adeline with a picture of that ice cream before actually trying it.
We can do that. I'll take you along for a pistachio tour as well, Luciana. We can do this.
Thank you.
It's going to be the Sad Python Girls Club pistachio tour coming to theaters soon.
Well, on that note, I would like to thank you, Alice, for being our special guest today. And thanks again, Kim Adeline, for being the co-host. And thank you all for listening to our episode today. Hope you have a great rest of your week, weekend, whenever it is that you're listening to this episode.
Thank you.
Thank you both.